What is it? She asked. Who was on the phone? It was Troy, helpfully letting me know that he has just paid Savannah some exorbitant amount of money, not to tell you that I harassed her. You harassed her? Joy looked at him blankly, trying to understand. Her first confused, irrational thought was that he'd harassed her to do tennis drills, like he'd once harassed the children. Sexually harassed her, said Stan. Your idiotic son actually believed it. He genuinely believed it. Joy stood. She crossed her arms. What happened? Well, I didn't bloody well sexually harass her, if that's what you're asking. Oh, of course you didn't, sighed Joy. Neither of them had been perfect. There had been parties. It was the 70s. They didn't exactly embrace the free love movement, but there was flirting. She was reasonably sure that Brooke once caught her kissing Dennis Christos at the Delaney's Christmas party in the clubhouse kitchen after too many glasses of punch. Dennis couldn't serve to save his life, but the man could kiss. Joy confessed it to Stan years later, and he certainly wasn't thrilled, but he didn't make a big deal of it, although poor old Dennis did start to look alarmed at the speed of Stan's serves. Stan might have strayed. It was reasonable to think that he might have considered it in the bad year when they truly thought they were going to separate. Women found him attractive. Joy had never asked the question because she didn't care to hear the answer. She knew it was possible to be kissed by another man and for it to mean nothing at all except that she'd put too much gin in the punch and Dennis was an outrageous flirt, although she still never doubted his love for Debbie. There were worse betrayals. But there was no way in the world Stan would have been inappropriate with Savannah. He had always been hyper aware of the propriety of his position when it came to children and young girls. Joy had seen the way he interacted with Savannah. He saw her as a daughter or a student. Did Savannah misinterpret something you said? Joy asked him. It could have happened when she wasn't there to smooth things over and explain to Savannah what her clueless husband really meant. Did you try to make a joke? Because these days you have to be so careful. For Christ's sake, I didn't try to make a joke, said Stan. If you must know, while you were in hospital, she gave me certain signals. What? Joy guffawed. Darling, she didn't. She wouldn't. You misunderstood. I don't think so. He pressed his lips together in the way he did when Joy served tuna casserole, the smell of which supposedly made him feel sick. So she only made it when she wasn't happy with him. I don't think I misinterpreted anything. Not now she's done this. Not now she's taken Troy's money. Joy looked around the neat room, at the book on Amy's desk, full of her tiny inscriptions about food. She had no idea who this person was. Her heart quickened. She'd opened her home to a stranger. Tell me. She cleared her throat. Tell me what happened. It was subtle, said Stan. So subtle that at first I thought I was imagining it. Just, you know, eye contact and a hand on my arm. And there was one day she came into the kitchen straight from the shower wearing nothing but a towel. And she kept talking to me. And I didn't know which way to look. And I thought, well, the girls always used to walk around in towels. They're your daughters. Well, I didn't know, said Stan defensively. I got out of the room as fast as I could. I felt very uncomfortable.
Why didn't you tell me? Asked Joy.
I thought you'd laugh at me, said Stan.
And Joy's stomach lurched with love and guilt because he was right. She would have laughed. It would have been inconceivable. It still felt inconceivable. How far would Savannah have taken it if Stan had responded?
That's why you wanted her to leave, said Joy. I felt sick about it.
Oh, Stan, said Joy. She went and put her arms around him and put her face to his chest. He stood for a moment and then put his arms around her.
I can't believe Troy, said Stan. He handed over money before he even asked me if it was true. He thought I'd thank him. I said, mate, that was borderline moronic.
Joy stepped back and out of his arms. He never gave Troy the benefit of the doubt. Borderline moronic. What a thing to say to his own son, who was only trying to help. She said, Stan, he obviously thought he was protecting you. Protecting me. Troy thought he was giving them a gift. She thought of Troy's hopeful face whenever he watched a family member open one of his thoughtful gifts.
How much money did he give her? Asked Joy.
She sat back down on Savannah's bed.
He said it wasn't that much, said Stan. It couldn't have been that much. It wasn't like she was covering up a murder.
Did he write her a check? Asked Joy. Can't he cancel it?
I don't think he has a checkbook. No one writes checks anymore.
Stan sat down next to her on the side of the bed.
I think he transferred it straight into some kind of account. The height of stupidity. You know what Troy said to me when I finally convinced him he'd been scammed? He said he didn't care. He can afford it.
He only wants to impress you, Joy sighed.
Yeah, well, that didn't impress me. It was dumb and disrespectful. To you and me. To our marriage. For him to think that I would... In our own home.
His voice trembled and her heart softened again. It was always like this with Troy and Stan. She was caught in the middle, her sympathy flying back and forth like a ball. She put her hand on his thigh, and they sat in silence for a moment.
So, what happens now? Where is Savannah? Asked Joy. I don't know where Savannah is, said Stan, but I told Troy to call his brother and sisters and get them over here now so we can discuss next steps.
Discuss next steps? He was puffed up with the self-righteousness of a wronged man, a rarely wronged man.
We need to be sure nobody else is handing over their hard-earned cash, Stan continued. We obviously need to get the police involved.
Oh, I don't know if that's necessary.
You need to check our bank accounts. She's probably had plenty of opportunities when you were out of the room to go through your purse and take all your credit card details.
Joy decided not to mention that not only had Savannah had plenty of opportunities to do exactly that, but she'd literally handed her credit card to Savannah on multiple occasions.
All her things are here.
Joy looked around her at the neat room. Surely she won't just leave them. She picked up Savannah's pillow and hugged it to her.
I think she might have some sort of eating disorder. Eating disorder? Stan said eating disorder like it was some kind of newfangled fashion choice. Who cares if she has an eating disorder? She just blackmailed our son.
Oh, well, said Joy, trying to imagine what in the world they would say to her. She didn't feel angry so much as blindsided. It felt like there had to be another explanation.
Oh, well, Joy, did you seriously just say, oh, well?
She's obviously troubled, said Joy. Have a heart. She could feel herself and Stan slipping into their old parenting roles in response to Savannah's actions. The angrier Stan got with a child, the more likely Joy was to defend them. And the worse the transgression, the calmer Joy's response. She was more inclined to shout about dirty laundry thrown on the floor instead of the basket than a serious-sounding telephone call from the school principal. If she hadn't witnessed the crime herself, she wanted proof, or at least to hear her child's version of the story first. Stan was always too ready to deliver a damning verdict before they'd heard all the evidence. She needed to talk to Savannah. She needed to talk to Troy. She believed Stan's side of the story, but part of her still felt as if this must be some kind of dreadful mix-up only she could sort out.
Joy, for Christ's sake, do you understand the implications of this? If she went public with this kind of accusation in this day and age?
Well, I'm sure she had no intention of going public, said Joy uneasily. And of course this is all very upsetting, but...
But what? Don't you dare call me borderline moronic.
Joy threw the pillow away from her and stood. Her eyes fell upon Savannah's glory chest. The boys had struggled to carry it inside that day they'd picked up her things. She lifted the heavy, hinged lid. There wasn't much inside. A stack of hard-bound journals like the one on Amy's desk, and a handful of old-style, battered-looking photo albums. Nobody really did photo albums like that anymore. They got those professional-looking bound books printed. Joy picked up the first spiral-bound album and flipped through it. It was clearly a child's album. The photos had been stuck in crookedly, and some of them were so out of focus, only a child would consider them worth keeping. The edges of the photos were peeling away from the sticky backing. She looked at a page of photos of two children sitting under a Christmas tree. It could have been a scene from her own albums. The dated summer pajamas, tousled hair, strewn wrapping paper.
Stan? She said quietly.
What?
She sat back next to him on the bed and dumped the open album on his lap.
What? He said again.
Look who it is, she said.
It's her, said Stan. Savannah, obviously, when she was a kid. Yes, but look who the boy is.
Joy slid her finger over to the child sitting next to Savannah. The big eyes, pudgy cheeks, and shock of hair. Stan stiffened.
That's not... It couldn't be. Why would it be?
It is, said Joy. It's Harry Haddad.
But why is Savannah with Harry? Asked Stan.
She's Harry's sister, said Joy.
I don't remember a sister, said Stan.
You only met me once, said a voice, and they looked up to see Savannah standing at the bedroom door. Chapter 41. For just a moment, the man and woman seemed to cower.
their lined faces slack soft with shock, as they looked up at Savannah from where they sat side by side on her bed, in her bedroom, except that it was clearly no longer her bed or her bedroom. This was no longer her room, no longer her home. What did she expect? That she could take a hammer to this delightful life and yet find it still magically intact? It was always meant to be temporary. Everything was always meant to be temporary. After Troy transferred the money, she would have accepted half as much. She'd considered never coming back, abandoning her possessions. But she'd felt an insane desire to spend one last night here, to be the Savannah that Joy saw, to experience one last time her fierce gratitude when Savannah placed a meal in front of her. Food was never just food for Savannah, and it clearly wasn't just food to Joy. Joy recovered first, straightened her back. "You're Harry's little sister," she said. "I forgot there was a sister." Joy looked at her with wary, searching eyes, as if trying to see her properly. And Savannah felt her personality slip away, and she stood on the precipice of that terrible, endless void. She was nothing. No feelings, no thoughts, no name. A plastic mannequin of a girl. But just before she disappeared into the void, before she dissipated like dry ice, a new personality clicked conveniently into place. She had thousands of hours of television at her disposal to call upon, hundreds of characters, lines of dialogue, facial expressions and useful gestures, a dozen ways to laugh, a dozen ways to cry. "Yeah, don't feel bad about it," she said. "Everyone forgets there was a sister." She was a new Savannah. Surname not specified. Dry, sardonic, cool girl. Could be the heroine or the villain. Could be the one to save the day or rob the bank. The viewer didn't know exactly what she had planned. Joy said, almost to herself, "I knew I knew you from somewhere that very first night." She looked down at the photo album on Stan's lap and then up again. "We only met the mother a handful of times," she corrected herself. "I mean, your mother." Joy's eyes searched her face. "Your parents divorced, didn't they? You went with her. Harry stayed with his dad." "Also my dad." For a moment, she was Savannah Haddad, with a mum and a dad and a brother. But the second her brother first held a tennis racket, everything changed. The Haddad family was sliced cleanly in two, as if by a sword. Joy said with a perplexed little smile, "I guess you didn't knock on our door that night because you had a good feeling about this house." "It was my birthday," said Savannah. "Was it?" Joy put a hand to her heart as if she would have ordered a cake if she'd known, and Savannah thought of the sideboard crowded with framed photos of birthday celebrations, as if every birthday was worthy of celebration. She saw a girl dressed so carefully and idiotically for a birthday dinner in a fancy Sydney restaurant, waiting for her boyfriend who never showed up, who never answered his phone. That girl knew her boyfriend had just forgotten. He got distracted. He loved his art more than her, just as her brother had loved his tennis more than her, and her father loved Harry's tennis more than her, and her mother loved her collection of bitter resentments more than her, and nothing would ever fill her hunger. She would always be hungry. Always. When she got back to the apartment that day, she took off her good clothes and put on the oldest, dirtiest ones she could find, and she made Dave pasta, and she was fine. She forgave him. She said, I should have reminded you this morning, although she'd reminded him the previous night. She drank her wine, and because she had not eaten all day in preparation for the special restaurant meal, it went straight to her head, and she floated free of her body like she often did, and thought, "Who is that girl sitting with that boy?" Then the news story came on the television, and the pastor blocked her throat as her brother's face filled the screen. Harry Haddad was announcing his comeback on her birthday. 3 years earlier, he'd been everywhere. She couldn't turn on the television without seeing his face. She would get in the car, switch on the radio, and hear his voice. She once saw footage of him signing a tennis ball for a fan and thought, "I gave him that signature." She was the one who worked out how to link the two H's in Harry Haddad with a flamboyant curl when they were kids. It was basically her signature. She had a right to use it. She'd started a business selling tennis balls, T-shirts and caps signed by Harry Haddad, and she'd done quite well out of it until somehow Harry's management team got word of it and it all came crashing down. Since his retirement, her brother had begun to fade from the public consciousness, from her consciousness, unless she looked him up, which she had learned not to do. He didn't exist. But if he played professionally again, he would once again be everywhere, on her phone, on her television, on her computer screen. She would slam up against her past over and over again, like slamming her head against a wall, like kicking a locked door. You are the failure. He is the success. Your father got the good one. Your mother got the dud. We are the poor ones. They are the rich ones. We are stuck on the ground. They are flying high. She had been so stupid to think she could ever be a normal girl who was able to go to a fancy Sydney restaurant on her birthday with her Irish artist boyfriend. The pain had begun in her stomach and radiated out. All she'd wanted was to escape the pain, and then she'd tripped over that damned guitar case and banged her head, and it had really hurt, and there was blood in her eye. The pain was everywhere, and the memories were refusing to stay locked up safe and sound. They were flooding like poison through her body and brain, and all she could think was that she had to get out of that apartment and away from those boxes and the boy. And it occurred to her that she should go back to where it started, as if she could travel back through time and stop Harry taking that first lesson. Or if not that, at least make sense of it. Or if not that, make that family pay for what they'd started. When she'd got downstairs, there was a cab dropping off a happy, drunkenly swaying couple at the apartment block, and she'd got in and asked the driver to take her to the Delaney's Tennis Academy, which she knew was just up the road from the house where her brother had his private lessons. As soon as she saw the sign with the smiley-faced tennis ball, she'd been able to direct the cab driver to the house without hesitation. The part about finding cash in the pocket of her jeans was nearly true. It was a credit card, not one that belonged to her. It was a souvenir from a previous incident. She wasn't sure it would work, but she tapped it against the cab driver's machine and the word "approved" appeared like magic. "I was thinking I might throw a brick through your window," she told Joy. She'd thought some low-level vandalism might be helpful, cathartic. It had worked in the past. "But I couldn't find a brick. I couldn't even find a stone." "What?" said Joy. "Well, it was a loose plan," said Savannah. Joy looked like she might burst into tears. "You need to leave," said Stan. He stood. He was still a big, intimidating man. "You need to leave our home." "I never did it," said Savannah. "I just thought about it." but it was so cold out there on the street and I was bleeding and I felt really dizzy. So then I thought, to hell with it. And I knocked on your door and I felt quite faint. And then, well, then you were both so nice to me. So very, very nice. It was strange. They were so kind and loving and welcoming. They treated her as if she were a daughter returning home. She was fed and bathed and put to bed. And because they treated her like a girl in need of help, she became a girl in need of help. And another girl's story from a documentary about domestic violence slid into her memory and became the truth. But why, said Joy, why would you want to throw a brick through our window? What did we ever do to you? I don't understand. She'd put on a little weight since Savannah had begun feeding her. So had Stan. There had been pleasure in watching their faces smooth out as Savannah increased their calorie intake. She was like the Wicked Witch in Hansel and Gretel, fattening them up before she ate them. I just hated this house so much, said Savannah. I hated all of you so much. Joy gasped in surprised pain at that, as if she'd burned herself.
We don't need to hear this, said Stan.
Be quiet, Stan. We do so need to hear it, said Joy fiercely. She was so tiny, but she could instantly quell that giant man with her quick, snippy remarks. Savannah found her inspirational. She already knew that she would keep some of her speech patterns for future use. What the heck? Oh, my word. Heavens to Betsy. Explain it to me, Joy said to her. Start from the beginning. Savannah took a breath. Was it even possible to untangle the multitude of memories that had led to this particular moment in this bedroom? I was the one who bought the raffle ticket, she said. That was the very beginning, if she threaded her way back to the start. Raffle ticket? Joy frowned. You mean the ticket for the free private lesson? The one Harry's father, your father, won. I gave it to him for Father's Day, said Savannah. I bought it at a shopping centre with my own money. My brother said, that's a stupid present. You would think when the ticket won, my father might have given me the private tennis lesson, not my brother. Imagine that. Harry might never have picked up a racket if I hadn't bought that ticket. Do you blame your parents' divorce on us? Asked Joy. Is that what you're trying to say?
We've heard enough. You need to leave, said Stan. You lied to Troy about me.
People made accusations of lying with such triumph, as if pointing out a lie won the game, as if you'd just shatter with the shame of it, as if they'd never lied themselves, as if people didn't lie all the time to themselves, to everyone. Did I? Said Savannah archly. It was always possible to plant doubt. Most men carried the guilt of their gender. You just had to apply a tiny flame to the kindling. She'd seen the terror fly across his face when she walked around the house in nothing but her towel. He felt compromised the moment he looked at her.
Stop this! Shouted Stan.
A woman's lie could terrify, but so could a man's shout. It made her want to hunker down and put her hands over her ears. She pressed on. You remember what you said to me? He'd never said a single inappropriate word. He'd been unfailingly kind. He'd been nearly as fatherly as Joy had been motherly. But Stan's fatherliness was a flimsy facade Savannah could smash with ease. Not with a brick, but with a lie, which was why she had to do exactly that, to prove it wasn't real. Look how easily she'd flipped him from affection to hatred. Love was never real, no matter how authentic it seemed. She said, "You remember what you asked me to do?" Not him, but another man. Not her, but another girl. There was another girl's awful truth at the heart of her awful lie. He loomed over her, savage with rage. "Stop this! Stop this! Stop this!" Chapter 42. Now. "Stop this! Stop this! Stop this!" Stop what? Caro Azinovich was 100% positive those were the words a man, it had sounded like Stan Delaney, shouted over and over on a coolish night last spring. Caro had been dragging her yellow glass and plastics bin to the curb, and she'd heard the shouting over the rattle and scrape of her bin and stopped in her tracks, a little shocked. She didn't know what had suddenly made her think of that night now, all these months later, as she carried a vase of dead tulips from her dining room into her kitchen. Should she tell the police about that night? When the police interviewed her, she told them that her neighbours were a nice, ordinary, happily married couple. This was absolutely true, and absolutely not true. There was no such thing as a nice, ordinary, happily married couple. But obviously the fresh-faced police detectives were far too young to get their heads around that. It was unusual to hear any noise at all from the Delaney's house. Of course, years ago, when all those giant children still lived at home, the Delaney's had been the noisiest house on the street. Once Caro had phoned Joy because she'd heard a kind of maniacal screaming as if people were being murdered, but it turned out they were just playing a board game that got out of hand. They were very competitive people. When the Delaney children came over to swim in their pool, Caro's own children ended up coming inside and watching television. "They're scary," her daughter had said to her. Caro studied the once bright yellow heads of her tulips, slumped over the side of the vase, as if overcome with despair. When she'd looked over at the Delaney's house that night, she had been reassured to see the familiar figures of Logan and Brooke under the porch light at their parents' front door. She'd hurried back inside before they caught sight of her and felt embarrassed about their parents arguing loudly enough for the whole street to hear. She'd assumed it was just an argument. Caro knew retirement could be stressful. No routine. Just the two of you stuck in your home, stuck in your aging bodies. An argument over a damp towel left on the bed could last for days, and then it often turned out that the argument was not about the damp towel at all, but about something hurtful that was said 30 years ago and your feelings about your in-laws. The newspaper articles were full of innuendo. There was no history of domestic violence, up until now. That was the implication. Had Joy been in need of a friend and Caro hadn't been there for her, the way Joy had always been there for Caro? Caro's son, Jacob, who had come over to mow the lawn, was chatting right now to a young female journalist from the local paper who was parked outside the Delaney's house. "I'll see what I can find out," he'd promised Caro. Caro bet that if Joy had been young and beautiful, the street would have been crawling with reporters. Joy had been so young and beautiful when Caro moved in across the road from the Delaney's all those years ago. She could remember when she first laid eyes on her neighbours. She was unpacking boxes in her front room when she heard a commotion and pulled back her curtain to see a family milling about right there on the street. The Delaney's always treated the cul-de-sac as if it were their own personal property.
A gigantic man, who of course turned out to be Stan, was talking to a young woman wearing very short shorts, her long hair in a ponytail. A fat baby bounced and laughed on her hip, while three older children played tip like it was the Olympics. Caro actually thought Joy was their teenage babysitter until Stan kissed her. Caro could still remember the way he pulled on her ponytail so her head tipped back as he kissed her. It had seemed stunningly erotic to Caro, a man kissing his wife like that right there in the middle of the street. But maybe she'd misread the signs of an abusive relationship. Caro had secretly rather enjoyed Fifty Shades of Grey, but her daughter had explained that the book was about an abusive relationship, and Caro had felt foolish because her daughter, who had struggled to learn to read, now had a degree in English literature. So she was right and Caro was wrong, and she should not have enjoyed that book. How embarrassing. The past could look very different depending on where you stood to look at it. The fat baby bouncing on Joy's hip turned out to be Brooke, who is now treating Caro's sciatica.
"Stop that!"
snapped Caro as the cat clawed at her pants leg. Otis stalked off, deeply offended. No doubt he would reappear in a while with a random piece of clothing in his mouth. Apparently, cats stole laundry for attention. Caro remembered how she and Joy had laughed when Caro returned the lacy underwire bra Otis had stolen from her clothesline. "That's a very sexy bra, Joy," Caro had said, and Joy retorted, "Well, you know, I'm a very sexy woman, Caro." How could Caro live here without Joy across the road? How could she finish their memoir writing course? How could she cope with the annual neighbourhood street party?
"They've found a body," said Jacob from behind her.
The vase of tulips slipped straight from Caro's hands and shattered on the kitchen floor. Chapter 43.
"We have reports that a body has been found in bushland in Sydney's north," said the radio newsreader. Su Lin Ho slammed on the brakes of her car. A car behind her tooted furiously. "Police are treating the death as suspicious after a bushwalker made the gruesome discovery late yesterday."
Su Lin raised her hand in apology to the person behind her, pulled over and put on her hazard lights. "A crime scene has been established and forensic officers are collecting evidence. There is no further information available at this stage."
"That's very sad news just breaking there," said the shock jock in the overly ponderous tone he used to indicate he was being serious now, folks, so listen up. "Obviously, we're all wondering and worrying if it's that poor missing grandma, and no one knows if that's the case, but either way, that's very sad news for some poor family." "She's not a grandma, you stupid egg," Su Lin shouted at the radio,
and then she burst into tears, because if it was Joy's body, she would never get to be one. Chapter 44. Last October. Logan was the first to arrive for the family meeting called by their father to discuss Savannah. He could see Brooke's car pulling up behind him in his rear vision mirror.
"We all need to be on the same page," Stan had said on the phone when he called just as Logan was leaving Dave's apartment, full of good pizza and information.
His dad had sounded upset, but he was also clearly in resolute crisis mode. The man of the house was going to fix this. How did one develop man of the house confidence? Did it just arrive automatically with fatherhood? Logan waited for Brooke to get out of the car, which she did with uncharacteristic haste.
"Savannah didn't just come here randomly," she said, slamming her door behind her.
"I know,"
said Logan. I was just at her ex-boyfriend's apartment. She's got some tennis connection.
You were? You talked to the boyfriend? What did you find out?
She didn't wait for an answer. She was speaking in a rapid, ragged fashion. She sounded like Amy.
This is all so strange. When Dad called, I'd literally just had this memory. I was looking at these bananas that Inez... But anyway, what about Troy? He believed Dad would make a move on Savannah. That's so disgusting. She's younger than me.
They walked towards their parents' front door. Logan could hear Caro from across the street pulling her bins out.
She probably made it sound believable, said Logan.
He wasn't going to bother giving Troy a hard time about falling for Savannah's story. Brooke knocked on the door while Logan turned back to look over his shoulder.
Do you think I should go offer to help Caro with her...
Stop this! Stop this! Stop this!
They both startled. It was their father's voice, raised in a kind of terrified fury that Logan wasn't sure he'd heard before.
Brooke had her key out of her bag first. She opened the front door with swift efficiency, shouting to their parents, Mum! Dad!
In here! Called Joy from Amy's old bedroom.
By the time Logan and Brooke crowded into the bedroom, the yelling had stopped, and no one was saying a word. Logan's father and Savannah stood opposite each other, his mother in the middle of them, her classic position of stopping an argument between two siblings. She had one hand on Stan's chest, the other on Savannah's shoulder. Logan's dad was breathing rapidly and furiously as if he'd just lost a long rally, while their mother had that look of controlled impatience she used to get when her children fought and she didn't have time to properly lose her temper because she had things to do. Only Savannah looked serene. A mildly amused smile twitched her lips. She stepped away from Joy and ran her hands down her arms, pulling her sleeves smooth.
Look who's here, she said. Are you all expecting dinner? I think we can stretch it.
What's going on? Said Brooke.
Yes, what is going on?
It was Troy, who had sauntered in through the front door they'd left open. He looked like a cocktail party guest, not a scam victim. Maybe Logan would give him a hard time after all.
She's Harry Haddad's sister, said Stan.
There was a pause as they all took that in.
I didn't know there was a sister, said Logan blankly.
Wait, was there a sister? Asked Brooke.
It's a lie, scoffed Troy. It's just another lie.
We're pretty sure it's true, but you're right. It's hard to see for the lies.
Logan's dad plunked himself down on Amy's old bed.
Maybe we should all go into the living room and sit down, said Joy. Talk this out.
Savannah said, I could heat up some...
Enough!
Shouted Joy. Logan's mother was a stick of dynamite with a very long fuse, but then all of a sudden,
kaboom! You can't make these terrible accusations and then suddenly cook for us. What's wrong with you? You're lying. You know you're lying. And if you hate us so much, why do you keep feeding us? I don't understand why you're doing it.
Her arms windmilled. She stamped her foot. Her children all took automatic steps backward.
Why? We don't even remember you.
I remember all of you, said Savannah. She dropped her chin and fiddled with the heavy green pendant at her neck. I only came to this house once. My mother and I were picking up Harry from his lesson. Normally my dad did that. Tennis was his domain. Logan got the feeling she was unconsciously parroting someone from her past. Tennis was his domain.
But my dad couldn't get his car to start, so Mum and I picked Harry up. Mum stayed in the car. She wanted nothing to do with Harry's tennis. She thought tennis was boring. Logan saw both his parents flinch at the casual denigration of the greatest sport in the world. "I remember everything about that day," said Savannah. She lifted her head. "You shouted at me that day too, Joy, just like you did then." Logan's mother recoiled. "What? Why would I have shouted at you?" "You were wearing a denim skirt and a paisley shirt with short puffed sleeves, and you had earrings like feathers that matched the red in the shirt. You looked very pretty." Logan saw his mother's face change. "Do you mean you were the child who tried to come into the house through the laundry?" "You're the kid who went through my school bag," interrupted Brooke. "Yes," Savannah turned to Brooke. "You shouted at me too, that same day." "Well, you were stealing my banana," said Brooke defensively. "I was starving," said Savannah. "Still, that didn't give you the right to..." "You don't get it," said Savannah. "I was literally starving." Her tightly clenched tone stilled them all. A space seemed to open up around her. "What do you mean?" faltered Joy. "Just that." "But I don't understand," said Joy. "You couldn't have been starving. I know for a fact your brother ate well. He had to play at that level." "My brother lived with my father," said Savannah. "I lived with my mother. Harry ate ribeye steak and potatoes every day. If he was going to play at Wimbledon, then I was going to perform with the Royal Ballet. That's what my mother said. My brother needed to be strong. I needed to be ethereal." Her lip lifted on the word ethereal.
"But what about your father?" asked Joy. "Didn't you tell him you were hungry?"
"I tried," said Savannah. "I tried to tell my brother too. But my mother told them I was making it up, being dramatic. I only went to my father's place one night a week. It had to be a weeknight because on the weekend, Harry had his tennis commitments." She said tennis commitments the way someone gives the name of their ex's new partner. "I used to stuff myself on that one night a week at my father's house. That's where I perfected my binge eating skills." She gave a ghoulish kind of grin. "Anywho, oh, Savannah." Joy dragged her fingertips down her cheeks. All that red-hot anger seemed to have left her as suddenly as it arrived. She looked sad and exhausted and old, and Logan remembered the feeling of disbelief as though he were witnessing a natural disaster when his mother's legs gave way on Father's Day. He moved closer. This time, he'd be ready. Joy said, "All I remember is that you and your mother lived in South Australia." "We moved there a year after Harry's first lesson with you," said Savannah. A chatty dinner party guest, quickly summing up her life story. "I didn't see my dad and brother anymore. It was like they forgot I existed. Dad sent money. I was just an annoying bill he had to pay, like the electricity."
"I'm so sorry."
Joy's hands fluttered helplessly. "Oh, no, it's fine," said Savannah, as if Joy had apologized for cutting in front of her in a queue. "I mean, there were some really bad years in Adelaide." She stopped. No longer the chatty guest. She breathed deeply, widened her shoulders, pushed them down and back, as if waiting for the music to begin.
she said. But then I gave up ballet. Best in the neighbourhood. One of the best in the state. But I was never an extraordinary dancer. The way Harry was an extraordinary tennis player. When my mother finally realised I'd never be as good at ballet as Harry was at tennis, she lost interest. So no more food deprivation. Hooray. Logan and Brooke exchanged glances. He could see his own doubt reflected on her face. Was any of this bizarre story even true? Logan knew that Savannah had taken the story she'd told him from that documentary. He knew that she'd lied to Troy about his father. So, wasn't it possible she'd also taken this story of a starving child in their midst from somewhere else? Did it even matter now? The facts kept slithering from his grasp. Trying to see Savannah was like trying to catch a true reflection in a funhouse maze of mirrors. The cadences of her voice, her gestures, her stance. He saw now how constantly she merged and morphed into different kinds of people. One moment she was a genteel, middle-aged lady, and the next she was a rough, tough-talking teen. Logan tried to take control with the facts he'd gathered, the facts he knew to be true. Savannah, I went to see your boyfriend, Dave. That story you told about him hitting you, it never happened. Savannah lifted her chin. Well, he would say that, wouldn't he? You lied to us, insisted Logan. He needed her to confirm the truth of this so he could find his footing and they could move forward. I know it's a lie. No, you don't, said Savannah pleasantly. Nah, mate, it was out, Savannah's brother used to say, so innocently and convincingly, so calmly when questioned on one of his calls. Harry Haddad was a natural on the court, and also a natural cheat. His flagrant cheating had enraged Troy to the point of lunacy, whereas it baffled and unbalanced Logan. He saw the ball go in, yet Harry said it was out. That called everything into question, right and wrong, the laws of physics. Lying clearly ran in the family. Stan met Logan's eyes and lifted his hands hopelessly. Logan didn't think he'd ever seen his father so defenseless, even when he'd been in the hospital for his knee. You were there that day too, Logan. Savannah looked at him coolly, and his heart lurched. I never met you, said Logan. He was 100% confident of this. You threw your racket at me, said Savannah, like I was a stray dog. I did not, said Logan. Why would I do that? Troy was the racket thrower. Yet another lie. I would never... He stopped. He saw himself walking off the court the day he first lost against Troy. The same day his father told him to watch Harry's kick serve. The day he understood that if he could lose against his younger brother, and if there were players in the world like Harry, there was probably not much point in continuing. Although he did. For another 5 years. Wait a minute. I wasn't throwing it at you, he told her weakly. He'd lost the advantage. He'd always felt bad about that little girl jumping clear of his racket. So you do remember me, said Savannah sweetly. She had her brother's ability to play offensively, pushing his opponent further and further back. She turned her attention to Troy. What about you, Troy? Do you remember me? I don't care if I did meet you, said Troy flatly.
Someone left the back sliding door open, said Savannah dreamily.
It would have been Logan. He was forever in trouble for not closing that sliding door properly because it jammed.
I walked in through your back door and went into the kitchen, said Savannah. I thought maybe just, if I could just get a glass of milk, anything. I was so hungry. I hadn't eaten anything for 24 hours. I was only 9. I felt so sick and dizzy. All I could think about was food. I was obsessed with food, and there was food everywhere. There were people eating everywhere, all around me, walking down the street eating ice creams, sitting at a bus stop eating pies, stuffing food into their mouths. But I had no money. I couldn't get any food.
Logan's mother put a hand over her mouth. Oh, my goodness, Savannah. Please let this be someone else's story, thought Logan, because his family were not bad people. They would have fed a hungry child. They sponsored hungry children on the other side of the world. Think of the poor starving children in Africa, their mother used to say if they didn't like their vegetables, and then Amy would become completely inconsolable, sobbing for the poor starving children in Africa, unable to eat, and Logan's dad would sigh and reach over to stab at her broccoli with his fork. Savannah said to Troy, "You chased me out of the kitchen like I was a beggar. You'd just got out of the shower. You were all wet. You had a blue bath towel around your waist. You called me a vulture." Her lip lifted again on the word vulture. "If I said that, I was right, because that's exactly what you are, a vulture," said Troy. He'd never been a defensive player. When attacked, he attacked back twice as hard. "You just stole a lot of money from me."
"I didn't steal anything," said Savannah. "You gave me that money of your own free will."
"Under false pretenses." "What did I do, Savannah?" said Logan's father. "What's my role?"
"Nothing," said Savannah. "You looked right through me. All you saw was Harry. I didn't even exist to you because I didn't play tennis."
"So this is about revenge, then?" said Troy. "Because our father made your brother a tennis star? Because none of us would give you food? But why didn't you just, I don't know, ask?"
"She did ask," said Amy from the doorway. "She came into the dining room and asked me to make her a sandwich."
Then she did the strangest thing, the thing that only Amy would do, would even think to do. She walked directly to Savannah and threw her arms around her. "I'm sorry," she said. "I'm so sorry we were all so awful to you that day. I'm sorry we didn't help that hungry little girl. We should have helped you."
Savannah stood stiffly for a moment, her arms by her side, and then she rested her forehead against Amy's chest, like a child being comforted by her mother.
"It was a pretty bad day," she said, her voice muffled. "Oh, my goodness, that is awful. That is really awful." Joy pressed her fingertips together in a steeple over her nose. Brooke turned away, her hand to her forehead. Troy looked at the ceiling, and their father looked at the floor. A strange young man in a very white T-shirt cleared his throat by the door. He met Logan's eye and held out his hand. He said quietly, "Simon Barrington, Amy's new boyfriend."
"He is not," said Amy over Savannah's head. But Logan saw the ghost of a smile.
Their father stood, his arms hanging heavily by his sides.
I want her out of my home.
He gestured with his chin at Savannah.
Now.
Dad, said Amy, we were awful to her. Savannah took a step away from Amy.
It's fine. I really don't care if we didn't make you a friggin' sandwich one very bad day in your very bad childhood, said Stan.
He jabbed his finger in her face.
Lots of people have bad childhoods. They get on with it.
Dad, said Amy, don't talk like that. Stop it. Stan ignored her.
If you're so jealous of your brother's success, go scam him. Go tell lies about him. Go throw rocks through his window. We didn't make any money out of him. Your family did nothing for us. Your father dumped us the moment Harry...
But it wasn't my father's decision for Harry to leave Delaney's, interrupted Savannah. Logan caught sight of his mother's face, haggard with fear. His stomach lurched. Savannah stood as if beneath a spotlight, her heels together, her toes splayed. All this time she'd had a grenade in her pocket. Finally she threw it. That was your wife's decision.
Chapter 45.
Now.
Guess what I finally got us, said Christina.
She slapped her phone triumphantly back down on her thigh. She and Ethan were driving towards the bushland trail where the body had been found, a 10-minute drive at most from where Joy and Stan Delaney lived. All the pieces were falling and slotting into place.
What? Asked Ethan. The motive.
Chapter 46. Last October. Stan didn't gasp or swear at Savannah's revelation. He didn't ask for clarification or proof or call her a liar. He seemed to know instantly that this time Savannah was telling the truth. Perhaps he'd always suspected, although he had never once asked or accused Joy. He said,
"Excuse me,"
to Amy's besotted young man who had been hovering in the doorway of her old bedroom watching these dramas unfold and who obediently stepped aside to allow Stan to make his silent, stately departure. They heard the front door shut. It was strange how very familiar it felt to Joy after all these decades. The wheel of time spun smoothly back, and her children were still her children, still looking to her to explain their father's actions, to make them normal and acceptable. She could feel all those old phrases springing automatically to her lips.
Don't worry, he'll be back. You know how he is. When your dad gets angry and upset, he needs to get away and clear his head. It's nothing to get upset about. Let's go have ice cream.
Is it true, Mum? Logan spoke first.
Did you tell them to leave?
Ugh, said Joy distractedly. She was thinking about Stan. It was all very well when he was 30 and 40 and even 50. But he was too old to walk dramatically off into the night now. He was 70. He had medication to take.
Yes, well, that part actually is true. Don't worry, he'll get over it. But did any of you park in the driveway? Your father won't be able to get his car out.
It was a cool night. He wasn't dressed warmly enough. He was wearing jeans and slippers.
Why would you do that to Dad?
Brooke asked Joy.
Her eyes burned with the betrayal of her beloved father. Dad was the one who discovered Harry. He should have been his coach. How could you take that away from him? Who would have coached you if your dad was travelling the international circuit with Harry? You would have coached us, said Brooke uncertainly. When? How? If her children ever had children, they might at least have an inkling of how Joy had staggered beneath the weight of her responsibilities through those difficult years. But it was Dad's dream, said Brooke. You took away his dream. What about your dreams? Joy held out her hands to indicate all four of her children. It didn't matter. We were never going to make it anyway, said Brooke. But you didn't know that back then, cried Joy. This is what you all forget. You all wanted it. You like to pretend you were doing it for us, but you damn well were not. The fury rose within her chest. She knew her children better than they knew themselves, and she saw their childhood so much more clearly than they could. You all wanted it. I know you did. The sacrifices you all made. Her voice broke. She remembered the weeping blisters on Amy's right palm. It's like she's been doing manual labour, said Joy's mother, disgusted. The sad, complicated resignation on Logan's face when he told Hien he'd have to miss his 18th birthday party because he'd be away competing in a tournament in Alice Springs. Troy, at 12, his cheek cushioned on the placemat at the dinner table where he'd fallen asleep while he waited for dessert. Brooke, tiny and determined, on the court in her pyjamas and sneakers, getting in some practice before breakfast. The pain, the exhaustion, the relentless travel, the parties and dances and school events they all missed. What if her children had endured all that and then seen their father by another player's side as he won the Grand Slam titles they'd all dreamed of winning? It would have been unendurable. Back then, it was a choice between her children's happiness and her husband's dream. And she was a mother, so there was no choice, not really. She chose her children. Remembering the day she'd done it was like remembering the day she'd committed a crime, a tiny crime without a weapon, as fast and simple as extinguishing the flame of a candle between her thumb and her finger, a fierce tingle of pain instantly gone. She'd picked up the phone when no one was at home and called Harry's dad, Elias Haddad. Elias was betting everything on his son's tennis. He'd given up his job so he could be his manager. He was living on his savings. Harry's mother and sister did not figure in Joy's thinking back then. They'd never existed for her. Elias, I need to tell you something in strictest confidence. Something my husband would never tell you, she'd said. And she spoke fast, without letting him speak, her eyes on a funny photo that sat on her desk of her sons, nose to nose. Funny because they were glowering at each other like two boxers. She'd always got on well with Elias. He was chatty and charming in that European way. She'd been able to convince him not to call the police when Troy attacked Harry. She said it would serve no purpose and take up Harry's training time. She apologized profusely on Troy's behalf. She pretended it was about jealousy, and he seemed to accept that. Now, she said, if you and Harry are serious about his tennis career, and I know you are, you need to leave Delaney's. Leave you guys, he said. And the surprise and alarm in his voice pulled her up short, but she barreled on. Yes, leave. Move to Melbourne. I'm going to give you the name of someone at Tennis Australia. Call her as soon as you put down the phone.
She's seen Harry play. He'll get noticed. He'll get the wild card entries at the Open. He'll be anointed. He'll become one of the chosen ones. It's all about the politics, Elias. She and Stan had always told the children there were no such thing as the chosen ones. There were no favourites on the circuit. It didn't matter where you lived or who you knew or who your parents knew. All that mattered was how you played. But there were politics in tennis. There were politics in everything. More importantly, he'll get the kind of coaching he needs, the kind we can't give him. We'd love to keep him, of course we would, and please don't mention this to Stan because I'm afraid my husband can't be objective about this. He wants what's best for Harry, but he also wants what's best for himself, and that's keeping Harry. But the truth is, Delaney's is holding him back, Elias, and I can't sit here and let that happen to your son. It's time to take the next step. She knew that Elias would instinctively understand who to charm and when, just as his son was able to strategize so brilliantly on the court. Elias might even have come to the decision to move Harry on from Delaney's himself if she hadn't suggested it. Elias did everything Joy told him to do, and he played it perfectly. He never said a word to Stan about Joy's betrayal. He winked at Joy whenever he saw her, as if they'd enjoyed a secret tryst. It made her feel as if she had slept with him. She later learned that Elias was a ladies' man who often juggled multiple beautiful women, so keeping secrets came easily to him. For a long time, she'd assumed Stan would discover the truth, and she'd been ready for it, ready to defend herself. But he never did. And after a while, she let her guilt, not regret, she never once regretted it, drift gently into nothingness, like the tiny black curl of smoke from that snuffed candle. She'd worried that Harry's memoir might reveal her secret. It had never occurred to her that her house guest, who had pretended so convincingly that she didn't even recognize Harry's name, would reveal it.